Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
So we were asked to answer, to address some questions, you know, why Shakespeare in a country like Brazil? What is its function in our curricula? How do we react to that? And of course, we were drawing upon the question of cultural models. As you know, we are in a third world country, and we are all very concerned with the relationship between the culture of the dominant and the dominated countries, and how that affects our teaching, our relationship to our students, the massacre to which we are submitted through mass media, radio programs.
I am, a third world anthropologist or ethnologist, and I decided that it would be interesting to put things upside down and say, well, me being from the savage wild world, the third world, I'm going to try to understand savagery, wilderness, you know, the wild man in Europe, in the first world, in the places where civilization developed, and try to understand why.
Cultural models and social domination, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen now for conversations about literature and anthropology in North and South America. You'll hear from Ana Lucia Gazola of the Federal University of Minas Gerais in Brazil, and from Roger Bartra of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. First, Ana Lucia Gazola discusses literary culture in Brazil and the United States. After that, listen for Roger Bartra discussing his study of identity and wilderness in first and third world anthropology. Ana Lucia Gazola writes that the colonization of Brazil resulted in the eradication of local peoples and their cultures. This, in turn, led to a Brazilian intellectual and literary system founded on imported values. Ana Lucia Gazola, welcome to the National Humanities Center. You've written a paper here with a wonderful title, Shakespeare in the Cooking Pot. What's going on there?
Well, I wrote this. This is really a very interesting title, and it has a lot to do with the type of work I'm developing in Brazil. I wrote it in co-authorship with one of my colleagues, Dr. Julio Pinto, and we were asked to write a paper to explain the response of Brazilian critics and researchers and professors to the teaching of English studies, especially Shakespeare. Uh-huh. And you know, Shakespeare as the symbol of Britishness, of the ideological role Britain had in the Western world, and the strategic function it has in the construction of English curricula. So we were asked to answer, to address some questions, you know, why Shakespeare in a country like Brazil? What is its function in our curricula? How do we react to that? And of course, we were drawing upon the question of cultural models. As you know, we are in a third world country, and we are all very concerned with the relationship between the culture of the dominant and the dominated countries, and how that affects our teaching, our relationship to our students, the massacre to which we are submitted through mass media, radio programs, TV, etc., you know. And this, of course, has a tremendous importance from a pedagogical point of view.
Well, I'm going to argue with you for a moment, Ana Lucia. How can you make the leap from a dead white European male who wrote way back there in the 17th century, the 16th and the 17th century, to the notion of cultural domination in modern Latin America?
Well, the thing is, domination is what things are made to serve, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is that all of the cultural models and the authors that belong to the accepted canon, to the literary canon, they are used as models, as sources or influences out of which our own literature and then our culture, part of our cultural identity, are constructed. Uh-huh. Well, we want to revert that model. That's not
what
a good
you
model
do
for
is
us.
You want to bring the Brazilians into the act and say, let's look at Brazilian literature on its own terms.
Well, let's look at whatever literature we are dealing with from our point of view.
All right, and what is that point of view? Elaborate that for me.
Well, for example, whenever I'm working with foreign literature, I don't want to look at it as if it had been the source or influence or a value that's higher and more absolute than the authors and the production that we have in our own country. Mm-hmm. But I want to work with it in a historical series, in a literary series, in which I will be concerned with affinities and differences. And I'm going to privilege difference over affinity.
All right, but isn't this after a fashion to become anti-standard? I mean, for good or ill, if we look back at Shakespeare mm-hmm. and say, here is the monument, here mm-hmm. is one of the starting points mm-hmm. or one of the major markers mm-hmm. in our notion of literary mm-hmm. development, mm-hmm. if you abolish, you're not asking.
No,
to
I'm not. No. I don't want to abolish Shakespeare.
Okay, all right.
But I want to see how Shakespeare was read in Brazil. How, you know, what productions of his plays were performed, mm-hmm. what types of plays were chosen, why some plays rather than others. Like, for example, the most performed Shakespearean text in Brazil in the 19th century was Othello. Now, if you think of the myth of the Latin lover,
sure.
and jealousy and passion and all of those characteristics that you people usually associate to us, sometimes we do too, you know.
Yeah.
You think of the type of passionate relation that we think is part of our culture.
Not to mention the racial dimension.
Exactly.
All
so
right.
that is very likely a play to be chosen and to be performed. Now, the interesting thing that interests us now is not exactly only why that play, but what version of that play was presented, for example, in our stages in the 19th century.
Uh-huh.
And they were usually Italian translations of French translations. You know, you see all the mediations, cultural mediations that you have there. So why this play? What type of production? Who were the actors? Who?
Mm-hmm.
What were the companies? What were the texts, the versions were used?
It sounds, I'm a little confused, Ana Lucia Gazzola. It sounds like you're doing a kind of chronology of literary history. But what does that have to do with the fact that Shakespeare is the dominant model? I'm still not clear on how we move from Shakespeare way back then into Brazilian literature today.
Mm-hmm.
And are we pointing the finger at Shakespeare? Are
no,
we accusing him of doing something wrong
no,
to Brazilian
okay.
literature?
No, he didn't do anything wrong to our literature, on the contrary. But the way Shakespeare was used, Shakespeare here for us in this particular essay is just a symbol of all the canon with which we have to relate. So he's really symbolizing a type of cultural attitude
uh-huh.
that accepts the model without any kind of problematization.
All right, now let's leave Shakespeare aside for a moment.
Uh-huh.
When do you look back, Ana mm-hmm. Lucia Gazzola, and say that Brazilian literature begins to assume its own legitimacy, its
mm-hmm.
own authenticity? Does that happen apart from these Western influences, in concert with them? Tell me about that.
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, ours is a derived culture, mm-hmm. right? We are a derived branch of the Western culture, and of course we still have as prevailing traits in our cultural life the traits of dependency,
mm-hmm.
the trait of dependency, right? It is a prevailing trait. So of course when we talk of a cultural identity, we are not talking of isolationism, and we are not denying the importance of the relationships of all cultural traits and cultural experiences, of course not. But we can also we can't accept either a passive role
mm-hmm.
of being just a derived branch. We have our own way of thinking, our own way of seeing, which is also part of this being a derived branch of Western culture.
All right, now let's talk for a moment about stereotypes. Before,
yes,
before
yes.
our taping session, we agreed that we would bring that topic up. Fairly or unfairly,
mm-hmm.
we look at Brazil and we say Carmen Miranda.
Oh, yeah,
we say
Carnival and the Lambada.
Carnival and the Lambada. We look at
yes.
Pele and
yes,
soccer.
Yes, right.
Why is it necessary mm-hmm. to break down these stereotypes, these cultural
yes.
stereotypes, and what do they have to do with your own Brazilian yes. national mm-hmm. literary identity?
Yeah. Well, the perverse side of stereotype is that it is a homogenizing procedure,
uh-huh.
and it denies all kinds of contradictions, complexities of a given society or a given culture.
Uh-huh.
It is, of course, a reductive way of treating complex reality, right?
In other words, the way South Americans would look at North Americans in the 1950s
exactly.
and say
exactly.
they all drove 1949
Mercuries.
They all drank
Coca-Cola.
They drank Coca-Cola.
They all looked extremely rich.
They all looked like James
yeah.
Dean.
Of course. That's exactly it. And that will deny
uh-huh.
the tremendous complexity and the diversity of experience that you have in this country, which is a very complex cultural, you know, a country that has a very complex cultural life.
Well, what should we know then about Brazilian literary national life that we don't know? How do we get beyond these stereotypes?
First of all, that we don't have only Jorge Amado as our main, he's one of our most important writers.
Jorge Amado.
Yes, it's Jorge Amado in there. And, you know, we don't have only his books, Dona Flor e Seus Dois Maridos, and, you know, Gabriela, Clove and Cinnamon, which has been translated here. And of course, Dona Flor has been made into a very good film with Sonia Braga and so on. So this is not all that we have. On the contrary, we have some excellent writers of a diverse type of production, and they haven't been translated here very often. Nowadays, in the last 5 years, there is, you know, a better usage. Some of my favorite writers are being translated now. I would recommend a Brazilian short story and novel writer, Rubem Fonseca. Yes, Fonseca, who wrote a very interesting collection of short stories called Happy New Year, Feliz Ano Novo. Mm-hmm. I recommend Silviano Santiago, who is a critic and a novelist, who wrote a very interesting book that takes place in the States called Stella Manhattan. It's a very interesting short novel. Uh-huh. And I recommend Otran Dourado from my own state, who wrote a book that has just been translated, The Bells of Agony, Sinos da Agonia. And also to name a very good woman writer, Clarice Lispector, who wrote several novels that are being translated now. Leah Luft is another very good writer.
All right, now you've given us a good list of starting points there. Let's talk for a couple of moments, Ana Lucia Gazola, about education in Brazil. Yeah. You come at this from a peculiar kind of standpoint. You have an American PhD from the University of North Carolina, and you are a graduate dean at the University of Minas Gerais in Brazil. What is it healthy, the educational enterprise in Brazil? In this country, you look around and everybody says it's gone to hell in a handbasket. What about what's happening south of the border?
We have been there for a long time already. If you people think we're moving, it is very difficult. You know, Brazil has is undergoing an extreme economic crisis, and we are going through a very bad recession. And of course, you know, health and education are the first project that suffered the biggest cuts. Mm-hmm. But I am the dean, and I teach at a federal university, which is, you know, has 23,000 students. And
how many? Say that again.
23,000.
23,000
students. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's been difficult. But the one important thing there is that the more you fight for education, for university, you have the feeling that you are doing something worth it.
Do you think you're winning this battle?
I'm not sure. I think the future will tell us, and I hope it tells us a better outcome than what we can anticipate from now. I think that things could be worse if we didn't have in the right places people who really believed in the project of education in Brazil. I think it's fundamental. It is what we have to invest upon if we want to get out of a situation which cannot be characterized by any other word rather than underdevelopment. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think this is really an important project, and I'm happy to be engaged in it.
Ana Lucia Gazola, I appreciate your time on Soundings, and I wish you well. Buena suerte in Spanish.
Boa sorte.
Boa sorte.
Muito obrigada. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Ana Lucia Gazola teaches comparative literature at the Federal University of Minas Gerais in Brazil. She specializes in studies about the interplay between the literary cultures of North and South America. This is Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on cultural models and social domination continues. You'll hear next from Roger Bartra, who is Senior Research Fellow at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. During his recent visit to the National Humanities Center, he delivered a paper entitled Identity and Wilderness. According to Roger Bartra, during the 16th century, some strange and intriguing symbolic figures arrived in America with the conquistadors. Bartra calls them Western wild men, and they're important to an understanding of the cultural identities of North and South America. Roger Bartra.
I think that you can find wilderness around us, around civilization, but also and at the same time complementing this idea, the wild within us, uh-huh. within civilization. So it happens that very early in European history there is a construct, an imaginary construct of the wild, completely different from what we know as the barbarian, mm-hmm. the other as an external, out of our boundaries.
What's the difference between your notion, Roger Bartra, of the wild, what you call an imaginary primitive group, and what in Western scholarship is has been always called the noble savage? Is there a difference?
Well, I think the noble savage is one of the expressions, the historical expression of this imaginary primitive group I'm talking about. Uh-huh. This imaginary group was created, was invaded, invented by the Greeks, for example, who distinguished many centuries before the noble savage idea was developed in Europe, many centuries before, they created the idea of the barbaroi, the barbarians, of course, but completely different, the idea of the agarioi.
Agarioi, yeah, now that's the wild man.
That means wild, savage. Oh. But the agarioi were strange people who lived inside inside the Greek culture. Generally speaking, there is a tradition which assigns non-tamed beings as being dangerous. Uh-huh. Dangerous not can be good also. Generally they are malefic. They are
malevolent.
Malevolent beings. But even in the during the Greek classical period, of course, in the medieval times, and surely in the 17th, well, from the 16th century, Montaigne's Cannibal develops during millennia, even the idea of a noble, of a good savage. No, so why? Because wild things are near to the there are kind of holes in or channels uh-huh. of communication between man and the cosmos, no, the nature. The nature has whole secrets that had to be revealed by certain people or certain beings who are in between the animal, the beast, and the human being.
Today we still call them scientists. In medieval times we called them magicians, people who tried to figure out how everything out there worked, whether it had rules and regulations, that
sure,
kind of thing.
Sure, one of the most well-known today magicians, thanks to Walt Disney's production, is Merlin.
Sure.
Merlin, who supposedly lived in the 12th century. Lives today. And he was a savage man. The stereotype of the wild man, the Homo silvestris, in the Middle Ages, was like Merlin, the one who became wild, ran to the desert, that is to say to the forest, right. Naked. Usually they were hated people, and get in touch with the whole cosmos, and then came back to civilization and
to teach
uh-huh. what they have seen and understood in that state of wilderness.
Well, tell me this, Roger Bartra, what does your scholarship about what you call identity and wilderness, this the other, the wild, what does that have to do with the sexual dimension of human behavior? I'm prompting you here to tell me about the satyrs.
Well, I think that's one of the main traits of the wild men, this Homo silvestris, Merlin, or the agarioi, or the cyclops. They have in common that they mean, in a certain sense, a sexual threat to the human beings. And that's why the satyr is a figure that is at the center of this stereotype of the wild man.
You've written, for example, that there is a difference between the sexual impulse and the mental impulse, what we call the will, that they're distinct, that one should control the other. Have I got this right?
Well, people during the Middle Ages developed the idea and the feeling that they could not manage, they could not control, the monks, for example, their sexual impulses, especially when they were sleeping. Uh-huh. That when you sleep, you make a lot of sins and you have no control of them.
We had to wait for Freud to come along and tell us about the unconscious.
Exactly, but that unconscious already existed. Uh-huh. In this image of the wild man. The wild, there existed not only wild men, but also wild women. Uh-huh. That's very, very interesting. Who threatened sexually also the knights or the people.
What were they called? Incubuses? Succubuses?
Well, those were devils.
Devils.
That's definite. That's the Christian demonology. Uh-huh. And the tradition of the wild men is a pagan tradition which comes from it's adapted to the Judeo-Christian tradition, but comes mainly from the Celtic traditions, the Celtic beliefs, and of course the Greek and Roman ideas of wilderness. So this idea of satyrs, and in fact the Homo silvestris in the Middle Ages is the continuation of that of the idea of mainly of the satyr.
Does this notion persist into the modern world? I'm sure it must in some way. I mean, our movies, our television are filled with sexuality, with temptation, with wildness, with absolution, with will, with control. Mm. How do you talk about it?
I think at all levels, in literature, popular literature or other kinds of literature. For example, in popular literature and comics, you find Tarzan,
sure,
which is clearly a wild man, and it's the kind of wild man I'm talking about. He is European. He's a Western being. No, but in a state of wilderness.
His name is Great Greystone. He's an English noble, isn't that right?
Exactly. Then there is in the other side, the Il Barone Rampante, Italo Calvino's novel of this man who decides to goes up, climbs a tree, and decides to live forever upon that tree. Uh-huh. And never goes back to the down to the earth.
Well, like the ancient aesthetics, the ones that climbed the pillars and stayed there. But here we have two different objectives at work.
The stilitas, yes. Uh-huh. Exactly. That is the same stereotype. Oh, then those wild boys and girls who, like the wild boy of Aveyron.
Uh-huh. They're called teenagers. We call them teenagers.
Well, today, now, exactly.
Right.
Or Caspar Hauser of Jacob Wasserman's great novel. So I think this is a millenary tradition, and which it's very interesting to study. I think that what the French historian Brodel calls the longue durée. Mm-hmm. Is what I'm trying to apply. He applies that idea mainly to the socioeconomic history. I try to apply this idea to the ideas, to the history of mentalities, of the mind history, the history of the ideas, and try to understand why certain ideas have such a long history, even if they are not very abstract ideas. The idea of the wild man and the wild woman is a very concrete idea.
Nothing abstract about that.
It's not has many abstract sides, but it's a very concrete idea, and can be traced from Enkidu in the Gilgamesh epic, through the Bible, through the Greek and Roman mythology, through the Merlin in the Middle Ages till today's...
All the way up to the Mel Gibson movies.
Exactly. That's it.
Does this speak at all to what we call the discovery or the encounter? We're about to look back 400 years at the time when Christopher Columbus, somebody found somebody. Who did the discovering? Who's really under the microscope now?
Well, as an irony, which I'm playing an irony with my research work, there is indeed a relation between the so-called discovery of America
and the encounter,
and the way in which I see things. What I am saying, and as has been said by folklorists and ethnologists in Europe, is that the savage has been invented before the contact, before being discovered and conquered. Mm-hmm. So that gives us a very different perspective, that things must be first invented and created, and then they are conquered or discovered. And that happened with the American savages or wild men.
Roger Bartra is Senior Research Fellow at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. During his recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Roger Bartra delivered a paper entitled Identity and Wilderness. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Cultural Models and Social Domination is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding conversations, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 573. That's program number 573. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, Wayne Pond will talk with writer Alan Gerganus. Alan Gerganus will discuss his latest book, a collection of stories and novellas entitled White People. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Cultural Models and Social Domination, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Ana Lucia Gazola of the University of Minas Gerais in Brazil and Roger Bartra of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Gazola discusses literary culture in Brazil and the United States. Bartra talks about wilderness and identity in first and third world anthropology. Cultural Models and Social Domination, this week on Soundings.